Thank you for downloading this New Zealand Sports Radio show. We have a new way that you can support us. There is a link in the notes down below where you can make a one-off donation to New Zealand Sports Radio. Thank you for support and enjoy the show.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello and welcome to the Driving Mall Show, episode 20. Wow, yes, that's when we've changed from being Hash Rugby Chats to Driving Mall. We're 20 episodes in. Wow, that's like 5 months of doing it this way. Boy, this year kind of seems zooms past and sticks around forever in both at the same time. Hi, I'm Paul, I'll be one of your hosts this evening because I like to think we've got a joint host this one, even though we perhaps don't. Perhaps I just bully and take control. But yes, joining me, Mr. Stephen Harris, my co-host. How are you doing, sir?
Very good. Thank you, Paul. Always a privilege and a pleasure to be on the show.
Absolutely. Privilege and pleasure is all ours for having you, sir. That's the right way around it should be. So the topics we're going to kick into tonight, All Blacks kickers. Obviously, we had Geordie kicking on the weekend, but Richie Mwanga and Dee McKenzie were also on the pitch. We've had some chat about the treatment of players by Julian. So they're obviously talking about Rico and his non-try, and we'll talk about that. Crowd numbers. Seriously, folks, empty seats at a Bledisloe Cup game and also disappointing numbers at the Minor 10 Cup. So we'll talk about what needs to be done there. We'll have a look forward to Bledisloe Cup 2 and also perhaps Ranfurly Shield defence number 5 this year, I think it is, down in Hawke's Bay. And also the big news that is rumoured is that Razzie Erasmus is going to say South Africa are not coming to Australia for the Rugby Championship. He is going to be citing player welfare, apparently. What does that all mean, folks, to the Rugby Championship? And can South Africa really turn down $25 million? That's the other side of it. So all of that this evening. Also, if you have anything that you would like us to talk about and you're watching live on Facebook, on our Facebook page, or YouTube, on our YouTube channel, or even on Twitter, at Driving Mall on Twitter, then you can ask us questions live in the show as well, and we'll have a look at those. For those of you that are listening to the recording on our podcast, we love you podcast listeners too. Don't forget, hit that subscribe so we come into your feed every single week and actually every single day with the morning sports briefing as well. So that's on iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, all of those wonderful thingamajigs you can have on your phone. Apps, that's what they're called nowadays. It's what all the young people do. Yo. Evening. Good evening, Nocturnal Rights, who is with us live on YouTube. Good evening to everyone else who is joining us. So there we go, Stephen. A nice little monologue from me for the first 3 minutes of the show. I better take a drink of my beer. And have you got a beer or are you on the old waters this evening?
No. I'm on a Del Mar tea at the moment. It's evening. Don't want to get into coffee or in your case, maybe beers. A little bit too early in the week, Paul.
What? It's Monday. Well, it's already time to get in there. How can that be considered early?
It's got me thinking. I wonder what Nocturnal Rights is drinking at the moment. Is he drinking maybe... Is he a healthy dude or drinking water? Actually, Nocturnal Rights could be a female as well, so I do apologise. So I'm not
absolutely
too sure.
We don't know. So, Monday night drinking. Some people might suggest that's a bad idea. You're probably right, to be honest. Yes, if there's a beer sponsor out there that would like to sponsor us, always up for that as well. So talking about that. So I'm yes, kicking us off then, literally. Jordy Barrett kicking sticks on Sunday, not Saturday, with Richard Mwanga, obviously recognised goal kicker for the Crusaders. Dane McKenzie, recognised goal kicker for the Chiefs. Jordy Barrett, recognised long-distance goal kicker, but not necessarily regular goal kicker for the Hurricanes. What are your thoughts? Was he the right choice?
Yeah, it was a bit odd, Paul. Probably a pre-planned thing for Jordy Barrett to do the kicking, I suppose. You know, with McKenzie at the back there, we all know that he can kick. He's an accurate goal kicker. I'd like to see their percentages to see who is the better kicker out of the lot. I suppose it's all a muchness, if you know what I mean. One thing I will defend the kickers with, it was probably a difficult day to kick down in Wellington with that breeze. Unless you're a Reece Hodgson, you can knock them over from 60, about 60-odd metres, which was a fantastic kick. And probably at the end of the day, the wind probably was the difference. You just kind of wonder if there was no wind around whether he kicks that goal. But just getting back to your question with the New Zealand goal, because I think they had the right guy, but just sometimes the conditions play their part.
Yeah, they do. Just bringing up some stats from 2019 as far as kicking goes. Richard Mwanga, 2019 Super Rugby, Richard Mwanga was at 85.96%. Quickly looking down to, obviously, Dane McKenzie was injured, wasn't he? So he won't appear in these stats, but trying to find a Jordy Barrett one in here. Jordy, 60%, wow. But he only had four kicks because Bowden was the primary goal kicker for the Hurricanes last year, wasn't he? Bowden, I just saw him and I scrolled past, but I can't find him now. In here,
Paul, basically,
Dane McKenzie, 75%, but only off six kicks. Again, say he got injured last year. So, those are the stats I have here for those for the players. I'll see if I can find a 2020 version as well.
I was about to say, Paul, based on those stats, maybe they did get the goal kicker wrong. Yes, it's just hard to know.
Yeah, it is. I think a couple of things. Apparently, Ian Foster said they had a kicking competition, and the winner of the kicking competition got to kick. I'm not a great fan of that personally. Kicking in practice and kicking in a test match are two very different things, and the pressure, etc. I think my coach should know who is the best kicker, and he should be the person who would make that call. It's a call he should be making. It's not something that. It should be a one-off sort of kicking competition that they should do, in my opinion. Some of the reasons for it. He's kicking at the Cape Tin, which is his home ground, right? So you'd think he would know the wind better or the conditions better than the other kickers. Perhaps I can see from that point of view. From the other point of view, he is a long range kicker. He's not your high percentage continuous kicker. At which point, I would go for either Dane McKenzie or Richard Mwanga for that personally. Another person also pointed out, look, in strong winds, you want someone who punches it through the wind, perhaps, rather than someone who is a sort of more precision, flighty kicker, as it were, with less sort of power. I kind of see that argument, but I'd say, look, these guys are high percentage kickers because they kick in all conditions, not because they just kick when there's no wind.
Paul, I was about to say, James O'Connor, I can remember him missing maybe a couple of kicks. At goal, I can recall him missing a penalty, yep. a relatively easy penalty, but both the conversions were pretty much from the touchline, if I recall.
Was it Dungunu?
Dungunu scored.
Yeah, out wide. I think you're probably right there. It wasn't an easy day for kicking. Let's be blunt. I mean, we're not sort of pointing fingers and saying that it's Geordie's fault by any stretch. It just seemed like it's just one of those tactical decisions that to me was just an interesting one there, and just have an opinion as to whether people thought this isn't. Yeah, I'm not trying to bag him and say he's a bad kicker. He's a dancer better than I am, or I've ever been, or ever will be. Let's be blunt. It just seemed like it was just an interesting one there. Aaron said, "Yeah, Geordie took all the kicks to Hurricanes this year." I thought Gordon Bashett did some, but happy to be wrong on that one. Nocturne Rights also talks about the local conditions as well.
You know, that's an interesting point, because we know Geordie as a long distance kicker, a guy that you can call up when they're around about that halfway mark. He can knock over those big kicks. We've actually seen that. And if you turn it on its head a wee bit and look at from an Australian point of view, they probably wouldn't start with Rhys Hodge as their number one kicker. So they've decided to, James O'Connor's been kicking all year. He's been, he was the pivot for the Reds, was he? This year. So he's been their number one kicker. He kicked for the Reds. Obviously, they have trust and faith in him. So they have stuck with him to kick the shorter kicks at goal from the shorter distances and use Hodge for the longer kicks. So they've got a plan. I think in the case of the All Blacks, maybe just a case of two sport four options, but maybe really and truthfully, I just think for somebody like, there's something playing out in my mind with Richie Moanga. I believe he's a confidence player. And I think if he's kept in the game, whether it's with goal kicking, I think personally he should have taken control of the goal kicking. He kicked relatively well in Super Rugby, if I recall. It's a weird one.
I think it's one of those ones where he had, I think from, again, it's just going off memory rather than looking at stats, from memory, I think Richie Moanga had like a shocker for the first two rounds and then came good from there. On that one. I mean, let's remember, Rhys Hodge started on the bench. He didn't actually start the game. And so you couldn't have him kicking earlier on. He did have that kick, obviously, when he came on. Boy, was that a monster kick. He could have kicked that one from like his own 22. it would have gone over. He just didn't quite get it straight enough. He missed by about that much, which is great podcasting. Basically, the width of a hand is about how far he missed. It really was a matter of inches.
Paul, I see Simon Hughes has just popped up there. Hi, everyone. I feel vindicated that Ian Foster is not the right man for the All Blacks job. Simon, I'd probably just hold the phone a little bit, but on saying that, if they lose their next two games, I think you're in the ball. I think you've got some skin in the game there.
Oh, lose the next two games and lose the Bledisloe Cup for the first time since 1906. Wow. No, that'd be crazy.
Could be one of the shortest ever All Black coaching reigns gone by lunchtime in 3 weeks' time.
Oh dear. And let's rest weeks. I'm saying 1906, so I can't remember the last time the Wallabies actually won it. It was a while ago. A lot of people it's difficult finding people who do have confidence in Ian Foster as a head coach. Let's be honest. We'll have to see how Foster goes. Nocturnal says, I predicted a result like this a couple of weeks back. You didn't predict a draw. Let's be honest, mate. There's no way. No one predicted a draw for this game. I think quite a few of us predicted it would be closer than some of the shock click pundits were suggesting it might be.
I think Nocturnal Rights is talking about Ian Foster's brother, Simon Foster.
Yes, that as well. Yes. I agree with him there. Simon Foster is not the man for the job.
No, you're right. You are so right there, Nocturnal Rights. Simon Foster. Just wouldn't have him anywhere near the team in a minute. sorry mate.
Now I'm going to do a little bit of sort of self-gloating here on the show, because hey, why not? No one else is going to blow my trumpet, so I'll blow it myself. Well, all what I'll do actually is I will bring up someone who was said a really nice thing about me on Twitter. So Paul Montague, clearly a man who knows his apples from his oranges, or whatever you want to say, because he said one of the few Kiwi pundits qualified enough to for an opinion on how the Wallabies might go today is Paul B, driving more. This is because he's one of the few who's watched more than 80% of Australian Super Rugby competition this year. The fact he's got a shrewd rugby brain. You know, so thank you very much, Paul, for that one.
Paul, I put up some comments today, and I've actually forgot where I actually put them up, and I probably should put them up on. I actually put them up on the new. I won't promote another forum, but I might actually put what I actually said on New Zealand Sport Radio. And I spoke about both the New Zealand competition and the Australian competition. When we watch the New Zealand Super Rugby competition, we see this amazing entertainment, a lot of ball movement. We see these wonderful tries constructed from everywhere and anywhere, and it's really entertaining. And then we got kind of critical about the Australian game, and I'll use the Brumbies as a benchmark. I think I even might have said during the season, gee, they're a hard watch, because they will basically grind through their forwards. They do use their forwards very well, especially when it comes to the line-out drive and also mauling. But I suppose, Paul, my question that I left answering, which is the closest style to Test rugby? Is it the Australian style where they grind out their wins, or is it the New Zealand style? And you've got to say, whether you like the Australian style of Super Rugby, it's probably closer to Test rugby, isn't it?
Well, I think there's a couple of things in that one, isn't there? In New Zealand, we have five provinces that are strongly influenced by the All Blacks coaches and by the and that philosophy of thinking, right? And have so the differences in game style between the New Zealand the Super Rugby teams and the philosophy of how they play is smaller than the difference between the Australian sides. So you've got a Brumbies, who will never kick sticks and will always kick the corner and have a very effective line out more. But you compare that then to say the Waratahs, whose maul is nowhere near as effective, and basically had some very light locks. So have to play a slightly different style. The Reds again with Thorn there again, forward orientated, but like to release those exciting backs when they can, much more than perhaps the Brumbies will do. So I think there's more variety of styles between them, which is one of those things why, again, I thought Rennie had was going to have a harder job than Ian Foster trying to get his style into those players, because he's not had the time to influence the Super Rugby teams to play his way. Whereas, let's be honest, the All Black philosophy that's been around through Ted, through Steve Hansen, and now into Ian Foster, it's an evolution, isn't it? That has been adopted by pretty much all of the Super Rugby franchises and most of the provinces when they can, and they've got the players to do it. So I think that kind of piece is, trying to say the Australian Super Rugby side is closer to Test rugby. Yes and no. Yes, it is for the Brumbies, but no, it's not so much, say, with Rebels.
Paul, I was about to say, leading into this Test match, I was on another website. It's a Facebook site, and like I said, I won't mention it, just because we don't want other people jumping onto it. But this particular website had picked another All Black team, and on that they were basically saying, "Well, this team would put away the current Wallaby team that Dave Rennie had." Now I was pretty upset when I actually saw that, because it just streaked of so much arrogance. And even me, I kind of feel vindicated. I made some comments on there. I said, for crying out loud, last year we saw an All Black A team get put away by the Wallabies, and of course our A team got put away by England in the Rugby World Cup semi-final. So what makes your second or third 15 better than a current international side at the moment? And quite frankly, I was actually quite rapt for the Australians what they actually bought yesterday. And quite frankly, I think New Zealanders have the lessons that we're learning at the moment is we can't look at this Australian competition and yawn and make faces and think, oh, some of the rugby's a bit of a grind, because at the end of the day, like you said, Paul, it's relative to their player base and the styles that each team is actually trying to play. And all Rennie has done, and we know he's a very good selector, he proved that back in 2012 when he pulled the Chiefs together, a whole lot of players that nobody knew, including one Brody Retallick. Well, I'll tell you what, he's got a bit to play with at the moment. I think they're in a really good situation in terms of he's introduced some young guys. They've got some more young guys waiting in the wing. I suppose from an outsider looking in, the only thing that might be concerning from my point of view, critiquing the Wallabies, is that we know James O'Connor is a very good player. He can be flaky at times, Paul. That's pretty much the only thing, but I think it's pretty handy when you've got Matt Tamua, the boy that was on the bench as well. Pelissa is his name. I can't
Lolly, think.
Lolasia. He looks a good, young, promising player. And I know they've got a couple of other young guys around, which just escaped me. I know the Reds had a young first five, and so did the Waratahs. So I think they're in a really good spot. Maybe not so much this year or next year, but for the next 2 years, Paul.
Yeah, I think we've a couple of points there. One, I'm going to flip to Simon Hughes' comment very briefly and come straight back to you, which is where he's gone. I don't mind the Australian competition except the Brumbies and that Phil Kearns. And I'll be honest, I don't mind the Brumbies. I do mind the Australian commentary. Boy, it's the worst in the world. But anyway, coming back to your points there around James O'Connor. Look, James, one of the problems that James O'Connor's had, and same applies to Kirtley Beale as well, is that they have been too skilled in the fact that they can play. James O'Connor can, and think he has played 10, 12, 14 and 15 at international level. He's never, and at a club level, again, he's played around all those positions as well. And he's never really had, until recently, a position and been told, right, that's your jersey and you're going to wear it for the next year and play every game. And with the Reds, he's been given that 10 jersey and said, right, you're wearing 10. I'm not moving away from there. Just learn how to just get used to playing 10. So when we've said he's a bit flaky before, maybe part of that is the fact that he's been shifted around all the time and not settled in a set position. But you're very right that he has been like that in the past. I guess the question will be, was that because of that, or is he less flaky now that he's used to playing the same position all the time?
Just consistency. And you're dead right. He got moved around quite a bit. It'll be interesting to see the reaction of guys who would be in this Wallaby team. And you spoke about Kirtley Beale before, but also the likes of Samu Karevi. We know what a good player Karevi is, and he's pretty young in the scheme of things. So it's incredible that they've actually got these guys who are not in Australia, but if these guys go away for a couple of years and come back pre-World Cup, boy, that just adds an extra bit of depth. To be honest, I'm very excited about them, Paul, and I just think it's great. I don't think a one-sided test match, as everybody was predicting, would have done anybody any good as far as I'm concerned. And most of the stuff I've been reading on the social network is quite positive, and the ones that are more or less critiquing the All Blacks and forgetting about the Australians need to have a long look at themselves. Probably it's a good segue into that tweet that Julian Savia pulled out, Paul.
Well, there is that one. I was going to also talk about something we've talked about a lot, actually, before we go there, around this comment that the young players have not played Kiwi sides at Super Rugby and therefore not been damaged. Mm. Also, look, the under-20s for New Zealand, or the Baby Blacks, we want to call them, have not been dominant at the under-20s level for a number of seasons now. The high school side has lost for a couple of years now against the Wallabies as well. It's not people, the players from around the world, not just the Wallabies, and now are not growing up getting beaten by people in black jerseys. And something that we've said probably about 6-12 months ago is that that removes part of the aura around that jersey. Now, the All Blacks, New Zealand Rugby has changed its philosophy around the use of those teams to be about building players forward, not about winning at that level. And you've got to say, well, actually, has that weakened the aura around that black jersey by doing that in that situation where players are used to playing a black jersey and beating it? And I think that might also be part of that as well.
Yeah, if you know you've played a lot of these guys at age group level, and these guys who go from age group level to all black level, well, hang on, I've played against these guys before. I can beat them. So, yeah, definitely a lot of that, Paul. Good point.
Yep. Aaron, we're going to come back to your point later, because I think it talks more, not just about All Blacks play, but also about something I want to talk about in crowd numbers as well. But so yes, let's bring up that Julian Sevilla Sevilla tweet there.
Paul, while you're bringing that up, Simon Hughes just makes a good point that there's good news in Australia on the TV front door, that Fox Sports and also Channel 9 are also competing, and it looks like and their streaming company Stan, which I've never heard of. So yeah, that's interesting. That's got to be a good one. And of course, Batman with a predictable comment. All Blacks no longer the force they used to be. Ian Forster, or Simon Forster, is out of his league. No, Ian Forster, I should say, is out of his league. They need to get Scott and Paul.
Razor, obviously, are you referring to there?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And we might come back again. That's what we might come back to as well. So Julian tweeting here and has said, the thing that frustrates me most about rugby here in New Zealand is how the media fuels the idiotic and sick comments from supporters, in quote marks, with their clickbait. They will praise you when you are doing well and briefing them, but when a mistake is made, we don't hear the end of it. And people wonder why we harp on about mental health so much. You want to be a supporter, then you stick it out with the players and team through the mistakes, bad days and good days, simple. Well, yes. And if you can't guess, folks, this is in reference to Rico Iwani's non-try just before halftime, where he puts it down with one hand or doesn't, and it rolls off the end of his fingertips and bounces on the ground rather than being put down there. So, Stephen, I'll be honest, I've been working all day, and I generally don't go on to the New Zealand Herald stuff or all these sort of pages anyway. So I've not seen these clickbait articles, but it doesn't surprise me. I stay away from those places because I don't like clickbait articles.
Yeah. Two things here, Paul. First of all, this tweet that Julian's put up, I wonder if it's coming from a personal space as well. It wouldn't kind of surprise me, given some of the criticism that he copped in France, and he's probably copped a little bit of criticism, excuse me, since he's come back. He hasn't exactly set the world on fire, and that's not a personal attack. I'm just,
well, it's also he's let's be honest, he used to come back from the off season, and there'd be lots of comments that he's looking fat, he's unfit, he's not the player, he doesn't train well off season. And used to get that sort of criticism as well from the New Zealand media, which obviously upset him as well. So, and we've seen his wife tweeting about in defence of him on social media. So, yeah, no, absolutely, he does have a there is definitely a personal element here that he's had a bad. A bad experience through the press, definitely.
Yeah, Nocturnal Rights makes a makes an interesting point, and he's dead right. It's a little bit like some of the interviews that we do at the end of games. Sometimes you'll interview players straight after a win, and they will gladly talk to you, and then you'll go to interview players who have been, you know, they've just suffered a big loss, and you can just see it's kind of uncomfortable, but you've got to take with the good with the bad, and that's what Nocturnal Rights is saying. I was going to say the other point with regards to Julian's comments, there are sometimes that some of these some media overdo it. I know the New Zealand Herald, that something that they will do, they will put a clickbait article up, and if they're not getting enough, how can I say it, just not getting enough wheels going, they will basically put it up again 4 or 5 hours later. They'll reload it, you know, so somebody else who may have missed it earlier in the day when it first came out, they'll basically reload it again, and it's the same article, and then they'll refresh it. Refresh is the word I'm looking for. They'll refresh it again another day later, so they will try and milk it for everything that they can get out of it.
No, absolutely. And look, I think there are 2 points here. There are the points that that Julian's making, which is around, as you say, that clickbait thing, and then some points we're getting here in the live chat that look, they should, that players will get criticised. Absolutely, they will do. And one of the things I was hoping we'd have Dwayne on here, because one of the things I was asking was, how does a player get to the top of the game, which, let's be honest, Rico is at. I mean, look, he's considered one of the best wingers in the world, if not one of the, if at the top there, and have basic errors in his game like this that haven't been ironed out already. So there are those. But during the game, people were saying, pull him off for that. And then there were also tweets coming out going, oh, he should be dropped for the next game. Look, no, he learns his lesson. Look, he's learned his lesson already. He learned his lesson 2 seconds after it happened. He doesn't need to be dropped for the next game to learn his lesson. He doesn't need to be yanked off the pitch to learn his lesson. That, to me, is what the things that Julian's referring to here. And I think, there was definitely an overreaction at the time. And the media obviously played on that as well.
You know, Paul, the other thing is that's probably infuriated a few people as well is Ian Foster's comments in support of Rico. I think it's all right to support your man, but quite frankly, in my situation, we'll be having a bit of a word to him about that. But one thing I can guarantee, he'll probably never ever do that again. And to me, that probably should have been the line from Foster. But it kind of infuriates people that they want the player to do the right thing. But as we've previously discussed, I think we discussed last night, this is something that's been waiting to happen if you look at the way that he actually does hold the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I want to bring in our first guest of the evening, Mr. John O'Connor. How are you doing, sir?
Hello, gents. I'm sorry to join you later. Thanks for your invite. I only saw it just a little while ago. I haven't read anything about the game yet, and I missed the first 30 minutes. Did I miss all the weeping and the wailing and the gnashing of teeth? Well,
No, really. I think we did a sort of game review last night where we so we've listened to that sort of more generic topics around the game. But I know one that you would, the one that we haven't talked about yet, but I know that one that I think you'd probably like to jump in on or have a go at is the choice of number 10 for the All Blacks, possibly in this one. And another player that has been taking some criticism has been Richie Mo'unga. And the fact that, again, another player, I mean, Aaron Smith came out straight after the game saying that he and Richie probably hadn't led the team around the pitch like they should have done. He clicked that before the whistle hit it, before the final whistle had even happened. But a player, John, that you've had reservations about when behind a pack that's not dominating.
Yeah, Richie Mo'unga has performed over the last 4 seasons. The predominant rugby that he's played has been behind that dominant pack. And any first five or fly half that's worth their salt will say to you that the game is easy if your pack is dominant. You're getting the ball on the front foot. You are able to dictate to your pack that when you want the ball and when you don't. A great example of this is Daniel Carter. You would see him instructing the forwards and passing the message forward and saying to them, I don't want that ball. That's rubbish ball. Sort that. You made that ball rubbish. You sorted out yourself. And only call for the ball when he wanted it, right? And if you are playing behind the Crusaders pack or you're playing behind the All Black pack, that is how you predominantly play your rugby, is on the front foot as the first five. Now, what would be fair to the young man is that maybe he, because he does that so often, he's got very little experience playing when his forwards are at least matched and he is experiencing pressure, right? And they are relieving on him to relieve pressure. And they're relying on him to control the game when it's not just an easy ride. And we saw that in some matches in Super Rugby, for instance. Was it last year? I think when the Sharks pack got stuck into the Crusaders in Christchurch, he looked nothing like the player that he did in other games. And we saw it in the loss against Australia last year. Was it in Perth, where the All Black pack was struggling? You saw it against England as well in the semi-final. And we saw it again yesterday. In that,
I think actually what's instructive
first, that he doesn't control the game as well. Sorry, I lost you there.
I think one of the things that actually I just thought about as well is that there were definitely comments about whether you call them late or not. But there was he was definitely taking hits after the ball, after he passed the ball, and the players who were targeting him, not in a legal manner, i.e., the man who was supposed to tackle him, got the shot in, and wasn't called up by the ref. So hence it was legal, and it was. They would commit to their tackle as quickly as possible because they knew that if they get those hits in and put that pressure against him, perhaps he wouldn't. That probably also played a part of it. But the Wallabies thought, okay, here's a guy we can target, and we're going
to they did it
as well.
And they went after him not only on defense; they went after him and Aaron Smith on attack, and they clearly identified that there is a weakness close in to the set phase or to the ruck in that link area between Aaron Smith and Richie Mo'unga. So you saw this is why so much of the play was off nine. So this is why you had Nick White drifting across and looking to draw and a number of times stepping off his foot and taking off because the gap would open because people would commit. So they had identified a weakness there when it comes to dominant tackling, both from Aaron Smith and Richie Mo'unga. So he was targeted both to get some shots in when he was receiving the ball and also to attack him and to penetrate and then to make continual ground across the advantage line in that close-in area. Now, I would give the youngster just a little bit of leeway in that maybe he doesn't play in that situation often. But one of the things that you need to do in that case is you need to be talking to your forwards and say, sort yourselves out. I want to see that ball shoveled back to me when you guys are under trouble. Sort your own problem out, right? Pick and drive, one-off runners, take it up, and then I will get you out of trouble. I will transfer pressure. But there was the other thing as well. His tactical kicking was poor. So there was a lack of taking control of the game on a number of levels from him. That's my concern about Mo'unga is that if the All Blacks are playing 95% of their matches, maybe 90% of the matches, because I don't think it's going to happen when they play the Springboks, where they have more than parity in the forwards, Mo'unga is going to look great. But currently, when they come to crunch games where they're under pressure in the forwards, then there's trouble.
I was about to say, guys, there was an interesting stat that I saw that the All Blacks in yesterday's game only actually had 38% possession. But more importantly, Aaron Smith stuck up 5 box kicks and they didn't retrieve any one of those 5 box kicks. In fact, one of the kicks actually went far too far. There was no chase at the time. And to be fair to the Australians, they dealt with all those kicks. And I agree with you, John, the All Black kicking game was very poor yesterday.
You know, it's one of the things you're told. If you've got a very strong wind at your back, it's actually harder to run the ball because the tendency for your pass is to drift forward if you've got a very strong wind behind you. Mm. So if you're trying to work the ball down the line, the wind is pushing the ball forward, right? It's actually easier to run the ball because you're less likely to pass forward when you're running against the wind. And in that first half, we saw quite a few of those box kicks taking place in the first half with the wind. And the time to box kick is when you are against the wind so that it hangs up. And you saw Damien McKenzie battle a number of times and he lined himself up and the wind would just push the ball away from him as he's trying to run in. So the Aussies were kicking a lot of box kicks into the wind. And most of those box kicks you're talking about, Steve, were happening in the first half from the All Blacks with the wind. It's not the right time. That's why the ball keeps on going too far. But where you should be doing is you should be driving it into the corners because you've got the wind with you. And there's only so many places on the field that the fullback can cover. And what you should be doing as the first five, you should be driving into the corners, especially when you've got, like the All Blacks did, the opposition line-out is under pressure. Put it in the corners and compete on the throw.
John, to me, it also highlights where the Australians had Tamoa at second five. We know that he's got a very good kicking game. We know that Banks at back has got a very good kicking game. But you look at the midfield, you had Jack Goodhue playing out of position, who's normally a centre. Jack can kick, but we also know that Rico Ioane doesn't kick at all.
No.
And unfortunately for Rico, he was horribly exposed, especially when the Australian scored the, I think Korobiti scored in the quarter. You know, just it's really quite simplistic, really, in its activation. But boy, they dragged Rico Ioane right in and caught him out quite brilliantly. So once again, a tick in the box to Dave Rennie. Along with that other little tick in the box was using, I thought, Taniela Tupou as the first receiver. We know he's a big, strong boys. And the South African boys will do exactly the same. They will use their big props, their big runners in exactly the same way. And, okay, you can meet these guys on the advantage line, but you need at least three tacklers to put them down. And if the ball is quick enough, that's where your halfback, that's where a Nick White or a Faf de Klerk will come into play.
They mean you can meet them on the advantage line. I guess the question is, are we going to be meeting them in Sydney or not?
Yep.
Because one of the things we've been hearing about for the past probably month now is that South Africa hasn't committed to the Rugby Championship yet. And rumours today are that Razzie Erasmus is going to announce before the end of this week that they will not be coming to the Rugby Championship, and he's going to cite player welfare. Now, is it really player welfare, or is it that he knows his team's going to be undercooked, and actually that they're not going to be competitive because of that? The players wouldn't get hurt, but they would get they would be at a disadvantage tactically, just not being conditioned as well. So is it actually player welfare, or is it just we don't want to take losses when we don't think it's a level playing field?
Well, I think, you know, South Africa has this history of wasting the opportunity of being World Cup champions. So they did they wasted it in 96, they wasted it in 2008 of not making full commercial use of the position that they had as number one team in the world. And I think what they've realized is that if they perform poorly, they lose that marketing advantage that they have. So there might be a short-term gain so far as the TV revenue, but a long-term loss if they don't perform well. Now, after that game last night, I thought to myself, the Springbok coaching triumvirate there, which is the new coach, Ninaba, and Razzie Erasmus as director of rugby for South Africa, that they would be, especially in the forwards, really confident about being able to handle both of those packs. However, a big part of the problem that South Africa faces is they've got a number of their locks that are injured and out. And both forward coaches for Australia and for the All Blacks should be thanking their lucky stars that so many of the engine room of that Bok pack is injured. And as a result, it might be that they're looking at it and they're thinking that the hit that they would take in their reputation as the number one team in the world is not worth sending an undercooked team. There was even talk about sending a team of youngsters to play and resting players like Kolisi or whatever. That could well be a commercial decision that they're basing it on to lose money in the short term in order to put out a team the following year, especially if they're getting some sort of guarantee that they're going to be invited to a Northern Hemisphere type competition. But say they've got some sort of confirmation that will take place, then maybe that's what they're basing their decision on.
One thing that isn't going to be an issue for him is world rankings as far as the Rugby World Cup draw goes, because World Rugby has said that actually they are going to take the world rankings from the beginning of the year for the seedings in the draw. If they were to lose places because because of losing games, then they wouldn't have that wouldn't be an issue. So that has been taken away as a reason for different countries to think to consider not playing games.
Just if I can reply to Aaron's question, yes, no question, the loss of Brody Retallick is a massive loss to the All Black pack, and you could see that yesterday. But South Africa has 5 locks. If you count Peter Steph Du Toit, South Africa has 5 locks, all of which would play for New Zealand. All of which would go to a World Cup in the squad. I'm not saying they would start, but all 5, including Peter Steph Du Toit, is World Rugby Player of the Year and is playing at Blindside. All 5 of them would be in the New Zealand squad. And yes, I know Barrett is injured, but I'm not sure that Barrett would beat out in a South African team those 5 players. So when you lose 1, 2, 3 of the 5 are injured, it's not just about the player himself. It's about the depth that it gives you. It's about the fact that you can bring on a player that will walk into any squad in the world at 30 minutes. And then you still have one that's left, didn't make the match day squad in case you got injuries. So, yeah. Anyway, that's just an answer to Aaron's question.
And John, just having that physicality as well, you just wonder with the likes of a Whitelock in the twilight of his career. Quite frankly, Patrick Tuipulotu was a line-out option, but he was a little bit quiet in my opinion. But if you look at from the Australian point of view, those two locks, Matt Phillip and also Salakai Lotu, I actually thought they were really outstanding in terms of the Salakai Lotu especially, in terms of the physicality that he brought to the Australian pack. I thought there were a couple of times he absolutely manhandled a couple of the All Black forwards, and he's a very, very big guy. And I think something the All Blacks have gone away from is we brought this up a little bit earlier, they play this exciting brand of rugby in Super Rugby.
Yeah, they do.
When we kind of look at the Australian rugby, where it can be a bit of a grind sometimes, and sometimes we were critical of the way the English Premiership is playing, you look at their rugby and think, oh, they're a bit of a grind, they don't play with any flair. But I asked this question to Paul before, what is actually closer to Test match rugby, the way Super Rugby is played in New Zealand or the way Super Rugby is played in Australia or England, or maybe even South Africa?
You're 100% right. I mean, the South Africans, of all the teams in the world, are the most physical, both historically and in recent past. So that's something that they pride themselves on, and you can see it in their history, and it's evidenced in things like the fact that John Olomu never scored a try against them, because that kind of play feeds into the psyche of South African players. Like, whereas the England players are diving for and the French players, and sometimes Australians as well, are like, I'm sure you can tackle Lomu. The South Africans were lining up. No, I'll have him. I'll have him. I'll have him. Right? Doesn't reduce his greatness in any way, but it's a mentality thing. And what's happened over the last while, and you've seen the expression of it in the transition from, say, Bismarck Duplessis, who's an incredible physical specimen, through to the current two starting, well, the two that vie for starting position, which is Bongi Mbonambi, who started, and Marx. Help me, Paul, first name?
Malcolm Marx.
The two, so the two that are, it's not Richard Marx, he doesn't sing. The two of them, who are amazing physical specimens, don't try all the time to run over people. They are stepping in more in the New Zealand frame and running at not running at shoulders, but running at arms, changing the point of impact, something that Kevin Mealarman was so brilliant at doing. So they're starting to adapt from straight trying to run over people to realizing that at the highest level, you're going to be matched sometimes in sheer size and strength. And if you want to make impact, you've got to change your angles and you've got to attack arms rather than shoulders. Now, the reason why it becomes so relevant in this discussion is the South Africans not only have a very, or at least in the pack that they had last year, not only have very good starting eight, they had their bomb squad, which was the complete tight five that they brought on, which were also outstanding players. And then they still had some players who didn't make it into the match day squad in the pack, and some who were injured. So there's this multi-tier of very physical, very large and players that are moving towards that kind of rugby of not just trying to run people over. And Nocturnal Rights was saying here on the comment section, surely there's a legal obligation to play if others can play. But the problem here is this is not the normal Sanzar tournament. This is not what they signed on to play every year. This is a standalone tournament that they tried to set up. So they're not obligated to play in this tournament. They agree to play in this tournament because the normal tournament would have been played August, September, and be finishing now. And they would be touring in
home away tests as well, and all sorts of other things in there. Yeah, you're right. The legal, there isn't a legal obligation to play these games. That's in the same way. It's not a home and away thing. Aaron says, look, it's unprecedented times. It's about getting out there and playing, not about financial lines. It's not what's being sold. Yes, to a certain degree. But also, the other thing is also here that I think we've not actually sort of touched on is we've seen a resurgence in New Zealand in Super Rugby Aotearoa, and also in also the level of interest in the first two rounds of the Minor Ten Cup when the All Blacks were there. Has been happening for many years in South Africa is a similar thing to what's been happening here in the Minor Ten Cup with their Curry Cup, where there's this talk of our traditional competition is devalued by not having the Springboks in it. They have an opportunity here this year to play the Springboks in that competition. Yeah. That competition started this weekend or last weekend. I must admit, I didn't see any of the games in that one. So there may also be an element of we've seen how well Super Rugby Aotearoa, Super Rugby AU has gone in those countries. We want to have the same thing happen here with a return to traditional kind of internal derby games. And we want to see that grow, and we want to see if we can, if that'll take off. So there might also be an element of that in there as well, and that it's about, it's unprecedented times. Here's our opportunity to give the Curry Cup a shot in the arm. Will that make it sort of sustainable in itself kind of thing?
Look, it's certainly the Curry Cup has been devalued over the years by Super Rugby, and the Curry Cup was a much bigger deal than the Mitre 10 Cup, the NPC, even the Ranfurly Shield. And that's not because the rugby was better, but it was the only rugby available for 20 odd years or whatever it was of isolation. So it became a massive, massive thing within South Africa. And it's nothing like that, because Super Rugby is one level higher than that. But I suspect that part of, if they do pull out, and I really hope they don't, I really, really hope they don't pull out. And I would like to see South Africa take the attitude that both New Zealand and Australia need South Africa to be in that tournament. They need the cash flow. They need the TV rights. They need what South Africa will bring. And I would hope that they participate because of that. But unfortunately, what New Zealand has done in the last 8 months or so is very much show South Africa that if the push comes to the shove, New Zealand is not going to do the same for them. And the level of arrogance sometimes that I've seen expressed from New Zealand rugby towards not only Australia, but very much towards South Africa is quite breathtaking. And South Africa, I believe, feel very much on an island at the moment, because they were sold down the river for the World Cup bid that went to France when they had the rated the best bid. And so they saw very clearly there that the Northern Hemisphere will line up together. And their one sense was that at least the Southern Hemisphere teams in Sanzar, that they would stand together. What New Zealand showed in their very much portrayed this reluctance to make a plan to try and include South Africa in Super Rugby next year was very much you're on your own, right? Sort yourself out. We're going to make a plan for Australia. There were many ways that you could skin this cat. You could have players come out and be in isolation, all sorts of things. And I think what South Africa is looking at now is going, well, actually, if we don't look after ourselves here, this kind of sense of brotherhood that is in rugby and has been around, especially in the amateur years where we're in this together and it's for the good of the game, seems to have leached out into the sea of, one, it's all for one and one for nobody else but one, you know.
Aaron's put in there, what about your obligations to Sanzar, as we are being told through the media here in New Zealand? I think partly there, you've got the media in there here in New Zealand playing very much to New Zealand Rugby's tune in that one, because let's be honest, New Zealand Rugby has when they turned around to Australia, to the Australian franchises, and said, "Hey, please make offers of interest to enter our competition." They didn't help themselves there. Look, I mean, South Africa. Whether off behind the scenes when New Zealand went about organising or considering next year, whether South Africa had already made indications behind the scenes, so they were going on wanting to go to Europe. It's been talked about for several years now. We don't know what was going on and how much was or wasn't known between those between the different unions as to what. Because let's be honest, South Africa have voted to take their four teams to go to Pro 16.
It's terrible news. Let me tell you, it's terrible, terrible news. I believe for South African rugby, as well as New Zealand rugby, and you're going to see the consequence of this play out over the next 5 years. And I'm very sad to see this happen. It's all very well for New Zealand to say, oh, South Africa has been talking about it for years and years. Well, that's fine. But when you say we're going to run Super Rugby next year and South Africa will not be allowed in, how did you expect them to survive? I mean, how did you expect them to pay their players? They had to go somewhere. Did you expect them to just run a little tournament within themselves while you...
We don't know how early or how long it's been going on behind the scenes, and it's been cooked. I say it's been talked about for many years. But anyway,
by the way, there was a comment from Simon about a report being biased. I don't know what report Simon was referring to. Do you guys know?
No, I don't. I mean, as Jordan says here, look, paint the full picture. South Africa started spreading rumours of moving north before all the Sanzar drama. Absolutely. I mean, Sanzar, they've been talking about doing it for several years. And going on to it as well. And so, look, it's...
What were you going to say, Steve?
I was just sort of wondering, as a competition, if it had run its course anyway, because all I was seeing was very, very poor crowds. In fact, the audiences were... not just the figures of people turning up to these games was down, but also the viewing audiences were down as well. I know for Super Rugby Aotearoa, that it seemed to rejuvenate rugby here in New Zealand, and I think that's pretty much where the New Zealand Rugby Union might have got it in their head at the time. Nobody else was playing rugby in the world, and they probably thought, gee, we got a really good product here. We can make all the rules. So there was probably a tinge of arrogance on their part. But, you know, countries will eventually come out of COVID. And I tend to agree with you, John, somewhere along the line, it might come back and bite them on the backside at some stage.
And when I said bite, we'll see the consequence. I don't just mean here in New Zealand. I don't think that it's good for South African rugby. I think South African rugby has benefited hugely from playing regularly against New Zealand teams and Australian teams at multiple levels and seeing the different ways that rugby is played in different styles. I think it's been very advantageous to South African rugby. So it's not just simply about New Zealand. But I remember Dan Carter saying in an interview in his last match, in his last match against the Springboks in South Africa, when he spoke about how special it was to go and play in South Africa, especially play on the Highveld, and the value that young New Zealand rugby players got from traveling regularly to South Africa to play Super Rugby games and being accustomed to what it's like to play in the very large stadiums on the Highveld, what the rugby culture is like, what the country is like, and how it prepared them to go play as an All Black in South Africa. And that's gone. Likewise, for South African teams traveling to New Zealand, it was hard enough. I mean, South Africa was averaging a win every 10 years, maybe, against New Zealand in New Zealand. It was hard enough when they were traveling regularly as younger players and new players in Super Rugby. It's going to be even tougher now with no exposure to traveling to New Zealand.
Reply to Aaron's comment. New Zealand media definitely not on the side of New Zealand rugby. Perhaps I was wrong there, but I think they are playing to a New Zealand audience. In their comments.
As to the comment, I just saw it. I didn't catch it in time about me loving Northern Hemisphere rugby. Can you confirm that, Paul? How much I love European rugby?
As he says, you love it when you need to go to sleep. So yes, perfect for you.
We're talking about the Six Nations.
As Aaron says, look, there has been mutual respect between New Zealand and South Africa for a long time, more than any other country, and it's a shame that might disappear. It's a great rivalry that's been around for a long time. Look, guys, we're over the hour mark. We've got a couple of other things I wanted to definitely talk about here. And Stephen kind of touched on it there, was around how crowd numbers and how the tournament had seen its course and crowd numbers were down. We saw this weekend that we had crowd numbers that they didn't sell out. The cake tin in Wellington for the Bledisloe Cup game. Now,
incredible.
Ashwin suggested last night there's been some creative accountancy in the past to make that happen. And maybe that is true, but it was obvious this weekend that there were gaps in the crowds. Also, I was at the Waikato game. They only had 1,600 people in the ground for that on Saturday night.
That's what they had last year, Paul. They weren't getting crowds last year. I can remember being at a championship semi-final. In fact, I actually commentated it 2 years ago, and there was less than 1,000 people at Waikato Stadium. They didn't get crowds anyway.
Last year they didn't open the second stand. This year they opened it with hope of getting 6,000 on the night. They didn't get that. There are other grounds as well that haven't had good ones as well.
I've got a theory on why that test in Wellington didn't sell it. Usually you get a lot of people travelling out of Auckland. Now, Auckland only just came out of lockdown just last week, so people didn't know what was happening. It would be a risk to book a ticket. I know that there's a lot of people that actually go down to Wellington and will book a ticket. So, listen, it was about 5,000 short. It was still a reasonably good crowd, and the ones that probably didn't go would probably regret not being there, because it turned out to be quite a fantastic finish anyway, guys. So as for Mitre 10 Cup crowds, I just wonder if it's a case of the New Zealand economy now starting to bite. At some stage, we pretty much had the government handouts come to an end. When did that end? 1st of October, I think it was. So I just think everything's just starting to bite at the minute.
They're getting down to ten bucks a ticket. So I personally, I don't think... at the White House, I don't think that's. I think cost can be. They can't get any cheaper without giving them away. Aaron says one of the comments he made earlier, though, was that is it the All Blacks have ingrained a play in a system with the old boys network refusal to try something new, like Razor Robinson? Is there also an element of within the Mitre 10 Cup provinces and also New Zealand rugby of it just being, this is how we try things. It'll be okay if we win. Do they actually need to think differently than they have been for the last 10 years? Is it just we'll keep trying it, and funnily enough, you keep getting the same result.
Paul, can I answer that one? I think half the issue with New Zealand rugby is a lot of the New Zealand teams are cloned by the All Black coaches, and there's a particular style that they want the Super Rugby teams to play at the end of the day, and they all end up playing the same sort of rugby, and that's what I can see. I don't think the coaches are given a free license to play a collective style. I mean, to say one thing I did enjoy about Super Rugby Aotearoa, there was a little bit more forward play to see teams actually using a forward drive to pull players in, you know, to my way of thinking, was smart rugby. Mark Watson always used to have a saying, you've got to do the work up front before you can go, you've got to earn the right to go wide. And that's at the end of the day, what good teams did. And I thought Australia did it really, really well. You know, the biggest mistake that New Zealand rugby could have made at this very, very point in time is probably letting somebody like Dave Rennie go.
Oh, you think?
I know.
Can I, before we go, Paul, can I ask Steve a couple of questions? Just a couple of response questions before you do that,
let me just point something that Simon's put in there. Great to hear that that there's an international rugby tournament happening on the 17th of October in Uruguay, between Uruguay, Chile, Brazil, and Argentina's B team. So fantastic to see international rugby returning to the I've gone blank, tier two nations in South America as well there.
I'm going to ask you a couple of quick questions to Steve. I just want to say this. I have read nothing about the game. I haven't read evaluations. I haven't read ratings. I haven't read match reports. So is it purely for me? Steve, what did you think of the new Australian number 8?
Pete Samu. He was pretty good. But I think you're probably talking about Harry Wilson, the blindside flanker.
I'm talking specifically that number 8. I know there's a lot of good stuff said about that youngster, Harry Wilson. He's got great potential, but I was very impressed by the number 8.
Pete Samu is a dynamic number 8. He originally played for Tasman in the Mitre 10 Cup.
Another one. Another one.
He's a really good footballer, but hey, the Australians, like I say, you know, credit, we all know what a good selector Dave Rennie is.
And, yep, through, so Tasman, Crusaders, over to the Brumbies, into the Wallabies.
He's a good footballer.
He's a real, he's a very good player. This is rhetorical, don't answer this. I used to, when he was still at school, and I was still living in South Africa, I watched clips of Taniela Topu, am I saying it right? The Tongan Saw. I watched him in high school. I cannot believe that Auckland Rugby and New Zealand let him slip away.
They tried.
Oh, no. Let's not go down the route of Auckland Rugby.
But anyway, it's rhetorical. Let it go. Next question.
Let me answer that. They actually tried both. Not so much New Zealand rugby, but Auckland and Blues rugby. He made it very, very clear that he wanted to play for Australia from a young age. Okay. So, listen, credit to him. He's a Pacific Island player who had his own mind and decided to make an early decision on who he wanted to play as opposed to hanging around wanting to play for the All Blacks. Oh, mate, he's going to be a sensational player by the time he's going to be one of the great players when he finishes his career. But boy,
he will be one of, if not the greatest Aussie prop in their history. So the next question, the All Black loose forward balance. Something's not right there. And I didn't have an opportunity to rewind and relook and try and find out what the problem is. But that loose forward trio, that balance is not right there.
Boy Robin, was Batman's assistant. Batman, I think Boy Robin is actually on the radio trying to get a hold of you at the moment, because Batman has said that the Wallabies will win the Bledisloe this year. You could actually be right, Batman. You never know, especially more so if they win at Eden Park on Saturday. Now, what was your question again, John? I got sidetracked by that.
The question before Robin distracted you, the balance of the All Black loose forward trio. Something's not right there.
No, definitely not right. You know, the guy who's been criticised the most, Sam Kane, I thought was the best out of the loose forwards there. No, it's definitely not right. And to be honest, it hasn't been right since Jerome Kainal and Richie McCaw and Kieran Reid were together. They just have not found that right balance. I still think Artie Savea, for all his leg drive and what have you, is not a number eight.
Well, here I have to differ with you, because I've been maintaining for years that he's an eight and not a seven. So I would be flip-flopping of major proportions if I did that now. But what I did feel is an issue is that the All Black scrum was not exerting enough control, because whenever there was like a vague open side, you would see Hooper would be covering Savia, so you almost never saw him get outside the forward cover and run at O'Connor, right, with all of his pace. And it just didn't seem to be that dominance to be able to take Hooper. They were switching him always to protect the open side, which he's supposed to do. But what I mean is he was always getting to Savia. Savia didn't cross the advantage line with his speed from the base of the scrum. Does it make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know if I explained this well. And then the last one is, and again, I haven't read anything. George Bridge was horrendous. And I'm not a big fan of Sevu Reese at the very highest level. I think he's really, really good. He's outstanding at Super Rugby level, especially with a dominant pack. But I have questions about him at the very, very highest level, not just normal international level, but the very highest international level. But Caleb Clark, my gosh, he is for real.
Yeah, got a lot of power. And listen, in a perfect world, my back three would be Caleb Clark. I would actually play Jordy Barrett as a fullback, because I still think it's a handy thing to have a fullback that possesses a really, really big boot that he's got. We know he's really good under the high ball. But I'd also have somebody like Will Jordan, who I think is really multi-talented and got really, really top end and pace. Once again, very good under the high ball. He's very good under a high kick chase ball as well. And of course, Caleb Clark, they would be my back three, and Bowden Barrett would be my first five. And you know what? Just stick with those guys.
But you okay, if you can't have Bowden Barrett on Saturday, if he's still injured.
If I can't have Bowden Barrett, I would have Geordie at fullback.
I'm saying if you can't have Bowden Barrett to play at first five, you play Geordie and you continue with Moanga at 10.
Yeah, I think you've really got no choice. I think you continue with Moanga at 10, but I'd like to see Geordie as a fullback. And that's no disrespect to D-Mac. We know how devastating he can be, but there's just something flaky about D-Mac sometimes. Every time he's running in to take a high kick, you kind of just cringe, guys, because he's not a tall man. He's a good little man, but I'd rather a big tall man at the back. I mean, so I was really impressed with Tom Banks for the Wallabies as well. He handled all the high kicks that were thrown at him. And whether we like it or not, rugby still at times is a high kick pressure game.
Mm.
Three-peat reckons Geordie Barrett would have knocked Corabetti into touch. Maybe, well, who knows? We'll never know whether he got over in time. But I will say, Geordie Barrett is much more solid presence. He does make mistakes or has been known to make mistakes. But I think, he's much more solid presence at the back there. It's going to be definitely a fascinating selection for the Bledisloe by the All Blacks for the Bledisloe Cup this coming weekend. You know what? I will try and put together some sort of video after when that comes out. But unfortunately, I'm working every day this week and also Saturday as well on the election, folks. So unfortunately, I can't promise anything. But we will try to get a video out about that when it comes on.
So to all the listeners, if your party doesn't get in the elections,
Paul. Thank you. I'm working at running a voting place. I am politically neutral at the moment. I was scared where John was going to go with that one. with my the current restrictions I'm under. Aaron brings up a really good article by Buck Shelford where he talks about the fact that number eights aren't just converted sixes or sevens, and that they are the brains at the back of the scrum, and that there is—it's a skill in itself. I've put a link to that article in the YouTube, Facebook, and Patreon, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter comments. So go check that out. Really good article on the New Zealand Herald. And I'll be honest, I very rarely say that.
just a quick comment. It's easy to forget that prior to COVID coming in, there was talk that Adi Sevier was the most outstanding rugby player in the Southern Hemisphere, right? In Super Rugby prior to everything being shut down. And where was he playing? At eight, right? So So he was absolutely outstanding at eight. So the fact that the loose forward trio is not working as a unit. It's not, the balance is somehow not right. And again, I can't tell you technically, I didn't have the opportunity to look deeply enough with all the stuff that was going on to see what wasn't working there. But the balance is not right. And that's what's putting him at a disadvantage. He certainly wasn't playing behind a dominant pack all the time when he was performing at that incredible level for the Hurricanes in the early part of the year. So
we've also remembered that
you should just throw in the towel on Sevier at eight.
Sure. But remember, this is his first season playing full time at eight, right? He's always played seven with occasional eight stuff. He's still got eight play. He's still got stuff to learn about in that eight jersey, for sure.
We'll have to get David Moffat back on the show again, Paul.
What, to talk about Adi Sevier at number eight?
No, just for your Batman suggesting that you should run him as the for New Zealand Rugby in 2023. So you'd probably need to get some tips.
I probably need to make sure I get my become a New Zealand national first to be allowed into that kind of role. I'm sure there's some restrictions on Englishmen being the chairman of New Zealand rugby, I think, but we'll see.
Well, Paul, all I can say is having had very close-up interaction with the senior leadership of New Zealand rugby and had panel discussion with them, you are not nearly arrogant enough to be the chairman of New Zealand rugby.
There we go.
Oh, brilliant. You will never match that KPI. Never.
One of the KPIs, you have to be arrogant.
There we go.
Folks, I experience arrogance. When I say breathtaking arrogance, I mean like that level of arrogance. So, yeah, that's not Paul, that's for sure.
So, there you go. Best person for the job, Paul. Thank you very much, Aaron. Yes, let's go. Let's start the campaign. John, thank you very much for jumping in at last notice. Very great to have you back on the show after a long time between drinks. Thank you very much, Stephen, for joining me yet again. Folks, from next week, Swinging from the Hip will be our Monday evening show. We'll be moving the Driving More show to another evening of the week. I haven't quite figured out yet which evening it will be. So I'm going to surprise you all, folks, with that next week. Thank you, John. Thank you, Stephen. If you want to support the channel, don't forget patreon.com/NZ Sport Radio is how you can become a supporter of the channel. Thank you very much, everybody. Paul is too nice for the role. Hope you've all had a great start to the week. It's Monday. Join us at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning for the morning sports briefing.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.